evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, May 29th, 2018. A top government official accuses the U.S. of pushing for a regime change in South Sudan.
For us as a government, this is not something new. This is a continuation of the policy of a regime change. So for us, it is not an issue.
And the UNMISS boss says the UN has two basic missions in South Sudan.
To protect civilians and to build durable peace. It's my profound hope that 2018 will be the year that peace prevails for the people of South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A senior South Sudanese official says the Kiir administration will not collapse and will continue to negotiate with the opposition despite threats by the U.S. to impose sanctions on high-ranking officials accused of obstructing the peace process. Information Minister Michael McQuay says the U.S. wants to see a regime change in South Sudan. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
The United States has drafted a UN Security Council resolution that, if approved, would impose sanctions against several South Sudanese ministers and other ranking officials, accusing them of obstructing peace efforts and blocking humanitarian assistance to civilians. The proposal includes asset freezes and a travel ban on six individuals: Defense Minister Kuol Manyang Juk, Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomoro, former Army Chief Paul Malong, Information Minister Michael McQuay, Deputy Chief of Defense Forces for Logistics in the South Sudan Army, Malek Robin, and Kwong Rambang, the SPLM-IO Shadow Governor of BHE State, who the U.S. accuses of leading military attacks in former Unity State and obstructing aid deliveries to civilians. At today's news conference in Juba, McQuay repeated his earlier accusation that the U.S. wants to oust President Salva Kiir from power.
For us as a government, this is not something new. This is a continuation of the policy of a regime change. So for us, it is not an issue.
McQuay called the U.S. proposed UN Security Council sanctions against officials like himself nothing more than idle threats.
What I can say is that we will continue to negotiate despite all these threats. Despite all these threats, we'll continue to negotiate in good faith so that we bring a lasting peace to the people of South Sudan. We'll not succumb to these threats because they are not for our interest.
McQuay insisted that all charges leveled against him and the other five South Sudanese officials have no basis in fact and dismissed charges of government corruption made in the past by U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Nikki Haley.
I'm sure if we were to ask Nikki today, Nikki, can you give us further clarification on these charges? I really doubt if she will be capable of it. But of course, whatever decision is taken in the Security Council is not based on anything other than political.
Regarding the latest pace of the IGAD-led high-level revitalization forum, which ended in Addis Ababa earlier this month without an agreement, McQuay says the Kiir administration will not sign any peace deal that allows former first vice president Riek Machar to be part of a future transitional government.
We cannot give out the position of first vice president again, give it back to Riek Machar, because we have learned the hard way from Riek Machar.
And McQuay rebuked South Sudanese citizens who say the government has failed them.
What do you want to do? If you want us to surrender, hand over the government to the rebels, or what do you want? For us, we believe that the only way to bring peace is to sit down, negotiate in good faith. There is no way someone would come and push out President Salva Kiir Mayardit, who was elected by the people.
Security Council diplomats in New York are expected to meet for negotiations on the text of the U.S. draft proposal today. A vote is scheduled for Thursday. Resolution needs 9 votes to pass and no fatal votes. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
On this International Day of United Nations Peacekeepers, the head of UNMISS says his mission is committed to protecting South Sudanese. But the country's leaders must show more political will to restore lasting peace. Chiba residents praise UNMISS for working to foster peace in the country, but say it should do more. Nabil Biagio has details for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at an event marking the 70-year anniversary of the UN Security Council's decision to establish the first UN peacekeeping mission, UNMISS boss David Shearer renewed the UN's commitment to protecting civilians in South Sudan.
We effectively are here to do two basic things, to protect civilians and to build durable peace. And it's my profound hope that 2018 will be the year that peace prevails for the people of South Sudan. And on that journey, you can depend on UNMISS to stand as your partner as we work towards that goal.
But Shearer says the responsibility of bringing lasting peace to South Sudan lies with its leaders.
Peacekeepers can work to protect civilians, but ultimately a safe, secure future can only come through political solutions. Peacekeepers can never be substitutes for the political will of the parties to end conflict. And through our UN's good offices, we will press on to find a negotiated settlement and a lasting solution, as we tried very hard to do at the latest talks in Addis.
Speaking at the same event, presidential advisor and Juba's chief negotiator at the IGAD-led peace talks, Nial Deng Nial, says his government is grateful to UNMISS for the peacekeeping work that's being carried out in South Sudan.
Their activities have made it possible to create a modicum of security in certain locations of the country, thereby facilitating the delivery of vital humanitarian assistance to all the needy. We very much appreciate that.
Despite the inability of the warring parties to reach a deal in Addis Ababa this month, Nial says the Kiir administration remains prepared to engage in negotiations with the armed opposition to achieve peace. He also called on South Sudan's partners to pressure militant groups into laying down their arms.
In order to arrive at peace in the Republic of South Sudan and eliminate the need of having peacekeepers and therefore being able to divert the precious resources that are being spent on peacekeeping operations to helping South Sudan build infrastructure and develop the country, the international community needs to prevail upon those still carrying arms that the government is ready and willing to sit down and address all the problems that beset the country.
Jeremiah Guy is an internally displaced person sheltering inside the UNMISS-run protection of civilians site in Juba. Guy says he fled his home in Juba 5 years ago when fighting first broke out in late 2013. He says all he and other IDPs want is peace so they can return home.
We support and we thank the United Nations mission in South Sudan for his protection, the civilians of South Sudan. We request the UN Security Council and TROIKA and African Union and European Union to bring peace.
Juba resident Emanuela Nyoka says she hopes the mission expands its operations to help protect civilians in remote areas of the country.
They are now protecting our citizens, and also they are monitoring and investigating all the work that the citizens are doing. The only thing that I need them to improve is to help really the citizens who are suffering, like for example outside Juba.
UNMISS runs 6 protection of civilian sites around the country, including camps in Juba, Wau, Bor, Bentiu, and Malakal, where altogether more than 200,000 civilians are sheltering. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
We turn to Uganda now, where African businessmen and pig farmers recently met to discuss ways of expanding the pork industry. They say there's an undeveloped market for the meat and value-added products. Reporter Magume Davis Wakarinj files this report from Kampala.
On your farm, embrace the practice of actually weighing your pigs. It is actually good practice because it helps you know whether your pigs are actually performing well or there is actually something wrong with your herd. As I told you, I said you can't feed sweet potato silage alone. You're supposed to supplement it.
Peter Lule Mulindwa, who works for International Livestock Research Institute in Kampala, is delivering a lecture at the recent Pork Expo held in Ugandan capital. The event was organized by a local company, Pig Production and Marketing Uganda Limited. Listening intently are 200 farmers from different African countries. One of the farmers here is Bernard Njau of Red Pest Farms from Nairobi, Kenya. Njau, who owns over 700 pigs, says he has learned new farming practices that are applied to his farm.
What I didn't know about mechanization is that with mechanization, I can completely reduce my cost of labor. Because in terms of sweeping the place, in terms of keeping the place nice and clean and dry, and in terms of ensuring that the animals are warm enough, because we lose a lot of their energy by trying to warm them. With this mechanization, they keep a lot of warmth, so you don't spend too much energy, you know, warming themselves, especially when they are young.
Bolaji Oluwole, a commercial pig farmer from Nigeria, says food scientists at the expo introduced him to better breeds of pig to purchase for his farm. He also says he has learned how to market his pork products.
Like 4 or 5 years ago in Nigeria, pig was not a meat that was really accepted by people, maybe because of the Muslims and all that. But now, surprisingly, pig is actually even competing with cows and beefs and all that. So I think it's the next thing in terms of protein coming up in Africa. People are actually adapting to the pig meats, and that's one of the reasons why I've actually gone into it.
Aren Sefuka, a piggery farmer from Uganda, says she usually depends on information from neighbors about how to manage her business. Now, Sefuka says she has new ideas for running her farm.
Now I know what to feed and what not to feed. Because most of the time when you mix this and that and the other, because you've heard it from other farmers, other people, you don't get results. Because most of these things we've learned today, they've been researched about. I know what to do and I know the exact feed which is going to help me grow in this big business.
Peter Lule Mulindwa says this is exactly what they want all the farmers to know.
We concentrated on feeding the pig. Because pig feeding takes about 62% of the variable cost that are incurred when you're actually rearing pigs. And also concentrated on diseases, especially African swine fever, because it causes the biggest losses to the farmers due to high mortality rates, with the mortality rates going up to about 100% on a farm.
Pig farmers at the expo were also educated on modern production methods like artificial insemination and how to produce value-added pork products. Africa's pork consumption has steadily increased over the years. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, says pork accounted for only 2% of consumption in 1960, but today makes up a third of all the meat consumed. Worldwide, pork at 40% is the most widely eaten meat, followed by poultry at 34%. A little more than half of all pork is produced in Asia, while Europe and North America produce most of the rest. Africa comes in last with only 1% of global production. However, pork is becoming more popular on the continent. According to TradeProbe, a quarterly report produced by the South African National Agriculture Marketing Council, South Africans consume more of the meat than the country produces. So, there is the market for both domestic producers and for pig farmers living outside the country. The FAO says in developing countries, small-scale and subsistence farmers produce half of all pork on the market. But in Uganda, a widening middle class has money to spend on pork and other non-traditional foods. And that's good news for the country's pig farmers. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. What's the latest on the Ebola outbreak in neighboring DRC? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today: What is the biggest problem facing your country's leaders?
Their lack of commitment, you know, commitment in the sense to solving or addressing the issues affecting the country's development. So, you know, if they are committed, they will be able to solve, to identify certain problems and solve those problems appropriately.
I think the very first is policy somersault and the lack of vision.
Leaders do not have programs for the country. Leaders, they don't put country as a priority. So that's why leaders are not willing to help or to come up with the programs that can at least put resources in the hands of the citizens.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus, and it's time for our Tuesday Health segment. And today we're talking about the deadly Ebola outbreak and what's being done to contain it. A senior official with the World Health Organization says he's cautiously optimistic about the handling of the Ebola crisis in Mbandaka in Equator Province of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Peter Salama is the WHO's Deputy Director General for Emergency Preparedness and Response. He noted that 90% of those at risk in the city have been vaccinated against the disease, including 400 people in recent days. Salama says he hopes to get the government's approval to try 5 experimental drugs to treat those affected and to help prevent future outbreaks. In related news, the WHO's revised plan to treat Ebola is budgeting for up to 300 cases between May and July. It's also increased the amount of money targeting the disease from an initial $26 million to $56 million. DRC health officials have begun a vaccination drive to control the outbreak that has infected more than 50 people and killed as many as 25. But as health experts explain, this vaccination drive is a carefully methodological process in which trust is a key element. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Health officials in the rural corner of northwest Congo that has been hit with Ebola say workers are seeking out those at the highest risk to vaccinate, a move that tries to cut off the virus at the pass while also making good use of the limited supply of the vaccine. At the moment, officials have only 7,500 doses of the experimental vaccine. World Health Organization spokesman Tarek Yasarevic explained the campaign, which began this week in the rural communities of Bikoro and Iboko.
This is not a general mass immunization as it is being done for some other diseases. We are looking into people who have been in contact with those who tested positive for Ebola and their contact. So we make a ring around the person who contracted the virus.
That is careful work and involves much more than medicine, says UNICEF field worker Jean-Claude Nzengu.
La grande mission que nous avons, donc en communication pour le développement ici, avec UNICEF.
He says workers go to the households to talk about the vaccination that stops transmission, the advantage of the vaccination, what the residents need to do, how to behave, and finally, take them to be vaccinated. Congolese health authorities first reported the Ebola outbreak in early May. This is not Congo's first encounter with the often deadly virus, which causes an acute, serious illness. The WHO puts a survival rate around 50%. But as health officials learned when Ebola rampaged through West Africa, killing more than 11,000 people between 2014 and 2016, earning public trust is a major element of the fight. Last week, 3 infected patients escaped from isolation units in the city of Mbandaka. 2 were found dead a day later, and the other was found alive and returned to quarantine. Yasarevic says it takes cooperation from the entire community for an Ebola outbreak to be defeated.
It is only human that people who have their relatives in an isolation unit want them to be at home, to be with their family home in what could be the last moments of their life. But we need really to explain to everyone that how disease is being transmitted. If a person who is sick is in isolation unit, it not only increases the chance of survival for this patient, but it will also prevent the spread of the virus to the family.
The vaccination drive began last week, with healthcare workers receiving the first doses. The experimental vaccine made by U.S.-based Merck Pharmaceuticals has been shown in trials to be safe for humans. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Kenya, more than 50 top officials will be arraigned in court today for allegedly stealing more than $100 million from the Kenyan National Youth Service. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the money was to be used to procure goods which were never delivered.
The suspects were arrested Monday, and according to Director of Public Prosecution Nurdin Haji, there is sufficient evidence to press charges against them. Among those to be arraigned Tuesday are Kenya National Youth Service Director Richard Ndubai and Public Service and Youth Secretary Lilian Omolo.
I am satisfied that the evidence is sufficient to warrant urgent prosecution and that it is in the public interest to charge the following. First of all, we have the category of the public servants, and we have one, Lilian Omolo, who was the Principal Secretary, Ministry of Public Service, Youth and Gender Affairs, Richard Ndubai, Director General NYS, Sami Michuki, former Acting Director General NYS, Nicholas O. Ahere, Senior Deputy Director NYS.
Haji says the suspects will be charged with conspiracy to commit corruption, willful failure to comply with applicable procedures and guidelines on the management of public funds, fraudulent acquisition of public property, and fraudulent making payments from public revenues. He says the investigations were about $80 million pending bills paid by the Public Service Secretary, Lilian Omolo.
The public servants will be charged with several offenses, including conspiracy to commit an offence of corruption, willful failure to comply with applicable procedures and guidelines relating to the management of public funds, a breach of trust by a person employed in the public service, willful neglect to perform official duty, abuse of office. My office is preparing to have the suspects arraigned in court to answer to the charges. In the first phase, investigations revealed that there was no procurement undertaken before monies were paid out. So there was no procurement whatsoever.
The process might see more companies and individuals put under probe and possibly prosecuted. At the same time, President Uhuru Kenyatta has condoned the act, citing that Kenya will not tolerate such.
We are no longer going to tolerate in our country unethical people. If you have been given responsibility, you need to understand that responsibility is a responsibility to serve and not to be served. And ethics is not about being given positions of authority, but it is how they use that position of authority.
This is not the first time the National Youth Service has come under scrutiny fraudulent act. In 2016, then Devolution Cabinet Secretary Anwar Iguru was caught up in a scam whereby almost $8 million was lost and no one prosecuted. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Refugee agencies and Ugandan officials are appealing for more donor funding to support the ever-increasing refugee population in Uganda. They say they have only managed to secure 10% of the required funding for refugee activities and for support for host communities this year. They warn that the inadequate funding could keep the country from extending services or potentially cut current ones. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
Uganda is currently hosting the highest number of refugees in the country's history, nearly 1.5 million people, and is receiving simultaneous emergency influxes from South Sudan, DRC, and Burundi. They join smaller numbers from Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan. But as the country continues to open its doors to the refugees, the numbers seem overwhelming. This is coupled with chronic underfunding of the refugee response, which is said to threaten the ability of the government and of humanitarian organizations to continue to deliver critical assistance. Joel Botro is the UNHCR representative to Uganda. He says they've received $40 million this year for the care of refugees and their host communities. The problem is that over 10 times that amount is needed.
We're in a dire financial situation. We cannot continue being at 10% funded, more or less, overall. We need resources so that we can continue this job. Otherwise, we run the risk of, in fact, not being able to sustain the efforts.
He says the underfunding is undermining their ability to provide basic services to the large refugee population.
World Food Programme may totally disrupt its own food pipeline, and you can imagine what that does. On our side, we will not be able to continue catering for the level of education we provide through partners. Health is the same thing, and this could create a very problematic situation on the ground. We should remember that the host population, but also the refugees, have a right to access to basic services. If we don't provide that, discontent may grow.
Botru warns that if the trend continues, it poses a great threat to Uganda's highly praised refugee model.
Uganda is a model for the rest of the world, frankly, in terms of its generosity, and so on. Making that fail would be really going contrary to the Solidarity Summit, contrary to the New York Declaration, on refugees and host communities, to the Global Compact that is supposed to be taking place sometime this year in New York, whereby donors are pledging to sort of support refugees.
Uganda is currently operating a comprehensive refugee policy where each person is entitled to a 50-by-50 plot of land for cultivation and settlement materials for construction of shelter and daily food rations for a period of at least 1 year. They are also integrated to access health care and education within the community they live in. Hilary Onek is Uganda's Minister for Refugees and Disaster Preparedness. He says that Uganda might have to rethink its policy to suit the available funding.
We give these people land where they settle. We give them security where they should be protected. They go to our health centers for medical treatment. Their children go to our schools. They benefit from our services. The service is designed for a limited number of people. Now it is catering for about 5 times. It's too much for a small country like ours. We need the international support. Without that, we may change our policy to make sure that we don't get all this burden.
The appeal for more funds comes in the wake of allegations of gross mismanagement, fraud and corruption in Ugandan refugee operations. A number of donor agencies have threatened to withdraw their support if the UNHCR or the government fail to take action. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Al Salam Wasal from a South Sudanese group. We've been listening to Al Salam Wasal. I'm Ayan Dang Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think about the show. You can find us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com or reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.